It is possibly the best thing to potentially ever happen to anyone, anywhere in the history of the universe. Ladies and gentlemen, the world famous Lil Sebastian.
What?
Yes.
No way.
Oh my God.
I never thought I'd get to meet him.
Truly him. Yeah.
Well done, Leslie. Well done.
Hello, and welcome back to the Tools of Ignorance podcast. It is Sunday, March 24th. We are back after another unexplained hiatus that we're not going to address beyond this sentence. So, Hudson Bolinski joins me now. Hudson, how are you?
I'm doing well, Jonah. I'm doing very well. I'm back in the tundra of upstate New York. And we have an explainable hiatus. Spring training, man. We're not on our game yet.
We were stretching out our arms.
And once we get to the season, we won't have these issues.
We got to build up our innings capacity. You can't start off going, 7, 8, 9 innings at a time, right?
Right, right. And after last season, I'm hoping we can both go 200 innings this year. But our bosses might cut us off at 160, with the TJ thing.
Yeah, well, I thought they were imposing an innings cap for at least me. I don't know. Probably not you, because you're a workhorse. But we're cutting me at 180, 175.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think that it would depend if we are in a playoff race.
Good point.
They might keep you in, but there isn't a good track record of keeping aces in the rotation in playoff runs. Well, aces with arm problems. So
if Mike Rizzo's listening, he's going to be absolutely irate.
Oh! I just realized that could all apply to Steven Strasburg. Oh, I didn't know.
See what you did there?
Mike Rizzo is definitely listening. Of course he's listening.
Why wouldn't he be?
I'm pretty sure every general manager listens to the show.
I was just about to say that. You know? Absolutely.
Yeah. I got 14 GMs emailed the show. They were the only people to email the show. And they were all pretty pissed that we did not record a show in a while. But before we get too deep into this conversation, if you guys want to email the show, like the Angry TMs did, you can do that at toolsofignorance11@gmail.com, and you can follow Jonah on Twitter @Jonah8264, and myself @HudsonBolinski. Okay, so Jonah, we're going to talk about the Cleveland Indians today, aren't we?
We sure are. Among other teams, because
yes,
with opening day but 7 days away, we sort of have to be a little bit more efficient in mm-hmm. terms of how many teams we're previewing per show.
Yeah, truth. Okay, so the Cleveland Indians last year, they won 68 games. They did not make the playoffs. They were not the worst team in their division. We have already previewed the Twins. But not a good team, not a good year. A lot of things went wrong for them in 2012. Justin Masterson took a step back. Ubaldo Jimenez is proving to be more of the Ubaldo Jimenez he was in recent years rather than the dominant one we had seen a couple years back. The team wasn't very healthy, and there was just a lot of general underperformance, and I think that you could look at last year's team and project them as more of an 80-ish win club that would, if a couple things went right, maybe they could challenge Detroit. That was at least my thinking entering 2012. But an off-season later, this is a team that I think we can project to be significantly better than 68 wins. But can we project them to be better than 500? Is this a winning team, in your opinion, Jonah?
No, I don't think so. They're not there yet. Total credit to them. They had a very busy offseason. They overhauled their club pretty aggressively, bringing in, of course, to sort of be the captain of the ship, Terry Francona, to be their new skipper. And they also added a bunch of pieces. They were very active on the free agent market, bringing in Mark Reynolds, Nick Swisher, Michael Bourne, Brett Myers. So, it was a very busy offseason. But no, I don't think they're quite there yet. They added a couple, what I would characterize as fringy guys, guys who, you know, they'll contribute, but they aren't exactly core pieces. And you look at the composition of their lineup and their rotation, and there are certainly more recognizable names, bringing in, you know, people like Reynolds and the aforementioned other free agent signings. But I don't think they're quite there yet. There's a lot of young guys in their lineup as well. And of course, this offseason, they also traded for Trevor Bauer from the Arizona Diamondbacks. So they're making moves to acquire mostly young pieces. I think that a lot of the signings that they made in this offseason are more stopgap things than anything else when you look at sort of their time frame and the window for contention, because I still think they're a couple years away. And guys like Nick Swisher and Mark Reynolds, you're not sure how productive and central they'll be in a few years when guys like, you know, Bauer and Francisco Lindor and some of their prospects develop and serve to factor into their major league club. But yeah, they're an improved club to be sure, but they're not quite there yet in my estimation.
Okay, yeah, I think I'm going to generally agree. You know, a lot of you hit a lot of the major points, but you know, the bigger overarching theme here is the process by which they constructed their team. It seems sort of odd when you first look at it that a team that just won 68 games would go out and sign Nick Swisher and Michael Bourne and bring in legitimate talents. Brett Myers also going to the rotation. You know, so this is a team that definitely brought in guys and did so in a pretty clear effort to make the big league team better this year. And at the same time, trading away Shin-Soo Choo, what they kind of did was they reallocated their resources, and I'm not sure that the organization is better, but I'm not sure that it's a hugely improved organization. It's definitely better, but it seems like they kind of just did minimal moves here and there. But the big one for me, I think it has to be the big one for everyone, is trading for Trevor Bauer. He's kind of the wild card for this, I think. If he can be the pitcher he is expected to be, the Diamondbacks kind of fell out of love with Bauer and felt kind of became disillusioned with him, and then, you know, or at least that's what we've heard all offseason. And he's still a guy who could be great. And so you start to look at that, and if he can really take those steps forward, and the bullpen's really, really good. They have, you know, they still have a lot of these guys who are kind of like tweeners. Mark Reynolds, Drew Stubbs, like guys who aren't that good, but you can see how they could be really good. You know, and so overall, yeah, I agree. It's a team that's good, but I'm not sure they're good enough yet. And I'm not sure really, like, short of Bauer becoming what he's supposed to become or what his ceiling is. I'm not sure where this team sees huge improvement over the next couple of years. And down the line and long term, what the growth here is.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a little bit of an older team. There are some younger guys, but you look at the younger guys being Kipnis and Santana and Masterson, really, Zach McAllister, Chisenhall. I don't necessarily think of them as guys who can be getting that much better. You know, a couple of them had down years, but, you know, they're also approaching their later 20s. Actually, I don't know if that's right. But, you know, I just don't see it as a team that has a lot of immediate growth to go out and justify a lot of what they did. But, you know, it's kind of interesting and cool. I really like that they went out and... It was cool that they got Bourne. I don't know if it was necessarily the right call right now. Their outfield defense should be great. You look at Stubbs and Bourne and Michael Brantley.
There's so much speed there.
So much speed. But really, is there a lot of offense there? There's some.
Yeah, I don't think so. Looking at just the way their lineup's configured right now, it's probably going to be Kipnis and Swisher and Santana going 3-4-5, and you know that's okay. It's not that good. And I mean, you look at a lot of their pieces towards the bottom of the lineup. Brantley, he had a pretty good season last year. You know, he had about .288, and he got on base in about 35% of his plate appearances. And you know, his contact ability, he made strides there, and he walked a little bit more. But these aren't really first division players. And I mean, just discussing it with you, the impression I'm getting is that sort of, I don't think that they're necessarily relying on a lot of immediate growth to come from within the organization, and sort of the moves that they've made are indicative of a direction that suggests we're going to look to compete in the next couple seasons with pretty much the infrastructure that's in place right now.
Mm-hmm.
And if someone like Bauer can come up and help supplement what we've already built through free agency and help the Major League Ball Club that way, that'll be great. But for the most part, the guys that we've acquired from outside the organization are probably going to constitute the core of this club for the next few years, and that's when we're going to look to compete. That's the time frame we've identified to be competitive. And I mean, this to me doesn't smell like a team that can even hold a candle to the Detroit Tigers in the AL Central.
No.
You know, perhaps they're hoping for a wild card berth. It's not perhaps the most tenable approach, or the way that you would it's certainly not the way I would want to run an organization, investing all that money to pray for a one game playoff. But you know, that's sort of what these moves suggest, in light of the points that you've made, that their farm system, outside of, you know, Bauer, doesn't really have a lot of guys who have the potential to come up and help immediately. Guys like Lindor and Paulino, who probably represent their other two top prospects outside of Bauer, they're still quite a ways away. And then outside of those two guys, there aren't a lot of impact prospects that you can reasonably rely on to make an impact shortly, or even contribute beyond role-playing guys or second division guys. So, hashing this out with you, it seems like perhaps this is the club, for the most part, that they're looking to compete with, outside of perhaps Bauer, or maybe they gauge how this season goes and then assess whether or not they want to make an addition after this season plays out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one thing that I just thought of, they do get Carlos Carrasco back, and Carrasco had looked really good. Had pitched well for a stretch. I don't know what his final numbers looked like in 2011. I'm not even going to – I'm too lazy to type his name in. But I know that he had a very strong stretch, and that it's finally started to look like the player that they thought and hoped that they were getting when they traded for him, traded Cliff Lee for him, I believe. He came back. Him and Marcin, and who's the other one? Luke Donald, is that it? Who came back in that trade?
I believe so.
And then Luke Donald is most famous for the having his foot on first base when, or no, he is the guy who was called safe during Galarraga's perfect
game. That's right.
He was safe, but not really. And that was pretty odd digression, but Carrasco could be back, and Carrasco should be back. He missed all of last season, so you know, you don't know. You know, he could be an impact guy. Maybe they have some insight there. And Scott Kazmir is interesting.
God,
if you buy into spring training stats, you're probably not very wise, but 13 strikeouts against one walk, and you look at where he was when he last pitched a large sample in the big leagues in 2010 as a 26-year-old, 93 strikeouts against 79 walks in 150 innings. And it's hard to believe that he's only 29.
It really is.
He made his big league debut at 20. And he struck out 239 guys in 2007 to lead Major League Baseball. But he was always kind of, he got by on good control and good pitchability. And if that went away, then, well, not good control, but good pitchability. You know, he was more of that kind of guy. And then when that sort of, when people started to figure him out and his velocity went down a little bit, it was really the undoing of him. But, you know, he's an interesting guy, and he's your fifth starter. So we'll see. Another guy, Cody Allen, is a guy who has pretty high upside for what he is. He's a reliever. I have talked to scouts who think he can possibly close someday. So he's an interesting guy, but you know, his value is very marginal because he's in a bullpen that includes Chris Perez and Vinny Pistano and Joe Smith, and you know, so he's a guy. He's an impact player. In some sense, he can probably pitch late in games, not definitively, but he's a guy. But his value is sort of marginalized, and so you know, there's nothing coming up tomorrow that's going to be like, okay, well, we're waiting on that thing, and when that thing comes, then it made a lot of sense for us to have signed Bourne and signed Swisher and Brett Myers and traded for Drew Stubbs.
Yeah, it's almost like the moves they've made indicate this like presupposition that Justin Masterson and Ubaldo Jimenez are going to return to form. And I mean, both of them within the past three seasons have put up very respectable numbers. Ubaldo Jimenez back in 2010, of course, had a sensational season with the Rockies of all teams, pitching half of his games in Coors Field. And then he comes over in 2011 in that trade for Pomeranz, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And
Alex White.
He just wasn't the same guy. You know, and I don't understand. This makes no sense to me. But he comes over to Cleveland from Coors Field, and his home run rates just soar. Absolutely ludicrous home run rates. Last year, he gave up 1.27 home runs per nine. His strikeout numbers went down, and his control eluded him a little bit too. The walk rates went up. So Ubaldo Jimenez is now two seasons removed from that really sensational season in 2010, and really a pretty strong track record of success. From 08 to 2010, he always had an ERA south of four, and you know, his fielding independent pitching was always suggested that he was even better than that. Had he been playing in front of a defense that was particularly efficient. So he just hasn't been the same guy at all in Cleveland. But, I mean, I guess the hope is now that he returns to form, now that there's a little bit more of a supporting cast with some more marketability, if nothing else. And then Justin Masterson, again, is another guy who regressed considerably in 2012 after having a really impressive 2011. Ground ball guy, you know, for the past 5 years, you know, he's always among the league leaders in terms of ground ball percentage. But last year, again, like Jimenez, he saw the home run rates climb. The walk rate rose by a full another free pass per nine innings. And he proved hittable. You know, he does eat up innings. He's thrown over 200 innings for consecutive seasons now, but he gives up a ton of hits. And, you know, the left on base percentage came down, suggesting that he was unlucky in the situation. He was giving up hits and when he was getting those ground balls. So, you know, the moves they made just suggest a hope, whether it's justified or not, that these guys will return to form and sort of recapture the ability that they've demonstrated, whether in 2011 or 2010. And outside of those guys, the guys you mentioned, newcomers, you know, Scott Kazmir looking for a little reclamation year himself, and then Brett Myers as well, after working out of the bullpen predominantly last year. So,
There's also the supposition that McAllister is going to be as good as he was last year. I guess. I mean, you know, it seems unlikely that a pitcher who is young and not a stuff guy doesn't have a sophomore slump. You see it every single year, guys who come up. I don't think he was technically a rookie last year. He might have had some time or enough time to not be a rookie last year. But McAllister, more of a guy who hadn't been, I don't want to credit him not being seen for how effective he was, but not being seen was part of it. not being seen prior was definitely part of it. And you know, he you can probably expect him to take a step back. It just makes sense. And so you know, the sort of assumptions, I guess, were assuming that they made were that our guys who are bad are going to get better, and the guys who are good are going to stay good. And it seems kind of risky, but I wonder if maybe there's not more pressure to succeed right now, and that's why they did these moves, or if there's something else going on. One thought I had when you were talking about Ubaldo Jimenez was, I pulled up his baseball reference page, and I noticed that he's allowed 32 home runs in his time with the Indians. And to me, I think what must have happened is that he must have changed his approach. He must have been very wary of the fly ball in Coors, and tried to pitch away from it, or away from the types of things that would warrant or would lead to long fly balls. And so he must have figured, okay, well, I'm out of Coors now. Maybe there are some other things that I can do here. That just seems like a logical explanation to me, that he must have been pitching differently in Jacobs Field or Progressive Field. And so that was one thought I had. But, you know, overall, it's a team that's better. I think they're pretty obviously better. How much better? I don't think they're better enough to be in the playoffs.
I would concur wholeheartedly.
Okay, so with that said, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back. And who's our next team? We haven't decided yet. It's either the Marlins or the Red Sox. Who do you think we should do?
Oh, man. Let's go to the Marlins.
We had a perfect opportunity to be like, stick around and find out.
Yeah, well, I blew that, didn't I?
I thought of it after I sent it over to you. But yeah, we'll take a break. You'll hear us more again in like 2 seconds, depending upon the length of the clip that we play in between.
This is a mistake. Why would you call it that on your menu?
I don't know what to tell you, man.
Just give me all the bacon and eggs you have. Wait. I worry what you just heard was, give me a lot of bacon and eggs. What I said was, give me all the bacon and eggs you have. Do you understand?
Welcome back to the podcast. Jonah, thoughts on the Marlins?
They're bad. Okay.
We'll be right back, and we're going to talk about the Red Sox in a second. Stick around.
The first course is a Mexican bean soup.
Ooh, Dios mío.
Are these peppers for consuming?
I wouldn't. They're very hot.
I'm going to give it a try. Hot.
You're very brave.
Please, that was one of the tiny ones. This is how you eat it.
Don't do that, Tom.
And welcome back to the podcast. We hope you enjoyed that very succinct analysis of the Miami Marlins. I forgot to add two words, Giancarlo Stanton, and that's about it. So now we are going to switch gears and talk about the Red Sox, a team who labored through a disastrous 2012, of course, highlighted by the failed Bobby Valentine experiment. People were very quickly disillusioned with Valentine, and certainly the performance on the field. It was, in every sense of the word, a disastrous season for the Red Sox, and they made some moves this offseason to address that. Of course, bringing in John Farrell from the Toronto Blue Jays. He's going to serve as the manager for the club. Mm-hmm. And also adding a couple of free agents, some notable ones, including Shane Victorino, Mike Napoli, of course. And they also have some very exciting prospects. Of course, right now it's the Jackie Bradley Jr. show in spring training. He's certainly opening some eyes, one of their top prospects, the outfielder. And, of course, there are other guys to be excited about as well. So, Hudson, I'm going to throw it to you and tell me what your impressions are of the Red Sox heading into 2013.
See, you know, people know that I kind of am into baseball. And so one friend of a friend asked me, man, are my Red Sox going to be good? Just a couple days ago. And I was like, well, they're going to be better. I don't know how much better. And I just don't know. I'm not saying, like, I don't know how much better. I'm saying I just don't know, because they have so many guys who are going to be difficult to project and to look at how they're going to add value to the team versus what they had last year. So, you know, is Jackie Bradley going to be great this year right off the bat? Probably not. Is he going to play a really good outfield for them? Probably. You know, the rotation, they have a lot of guys who are either trying to bounce back or coming back from injuries. You know, there are wild cards there. Dempster is good. Dempster is a good addition. Victorino is a good addition, but, you know, a guy who's on the wrong side of 30. Napoli. Napoli is going to be first base only, but Napoli could really hit. He did it in Texas, an offensive heavy environment. But not that Boston isn't going to be conducive to offense for Napoli. But you know, there are a lot of, I like the Indians. There are a lot of guys here who have a lot of variability, I think, whether it's from injury, sophomore seasons, rookie seasons, you know, there's, and I think they sort of made some assumptions. They made fewer assumptions, and I think their signings were probably better timed than some of the Indians signings that we talked about earlier. I think this is a team that's probably in that 85 win range. Just looking at all of it, and the expected health of everyone, I think this is a team that's in that 85 win range, but I could definitely seeing them being a lot better than that. I could see them being 90 wins or 95, because there's just so much variability there. When we look at it all, it's a good team. It's definitely a good team. And the prospects are good too. And the close prospects are good. So, you know, if John Lackey is just terrible, then you can do something with him, and you can call up Ruby De La Rosa or Alan Webster or Drake Britton. Or, you know, you can call up those guys. You can call on those guys who are right there. You know, so there's a lot more going on and a lot more flexibility with this team than there is in Cleveland. And I think it's a good team, and a team that could be really good.
Well, I just think that there's a stronger foundation in Boston than there is in Cleveland in terms of when they went out and made their moves. I mean, Boston, despite the way they performed last year, there's still a lot of talent, and they got very unlucky when it came to injuries last year. And I think that raises probably the most pervasive concern for the Red Sox, which is health. Because you look up and down their lineup and rotation, and there's a lot of guys there who are coming off serious injuries from last season, who missed considerable amounts of time, or who have bad histories with injury, or who are aging. And, you know, their bodies are breaking down, they're more susceptible to injury. Ellsbury has proven that, you know, he's something of an injury concern. Dustin Pedroia is usually good for a DL stint per season. John Lackey, of course, missed all of 2012. So there's a lot of questions there about health and about how guys are going to bounce back from that. But you're absolutely right. There is way more variability. And, you know, they have sort of that luxury of having prospects who are ready to go, or at least are indicating they're ready to go, should guys at the big league level falter. But, you know, a lot of people sort of wrote off the Red Sox considering how poorly they performed last year. But, you know, I like this team, and especially considering the way that the Yankees have been so decimated by injury in spring training so far, I think that the Red Sox are something of a I don't want to say dark horse because they're Boston and they're sort of never under the radar, but I think that they can win, like you said, 85, maybe even 90 games if everything breaks right. And, you know, even the young guys in their lineup show promise, even if they themselves are dealing with injury history. Will Mitterbrooks was great last year until he sustained that wrist injury. And, you know, Jose Iglesias looks like he's going to break camp with the club. And, you know, even if he doesn't hit, he's going to play a premium defense at shortstop. So
he's going to be fun. He's going to be a lot of fun to watch.
Definitely. And, I mean, Shane Victorino, even though, like you said, most of his stats are sort of trending in the wrong direction, playing in right field, I think, will be good for him as he's not going to have to cover as much ground as he would have playing in center field.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if Bradley breaks camp with the team, I don't think he will. But, you know, they could sort of employ a platoon in left field, maybe of Mike Karp and Daniel Nava, or Johnny Gomes and Daniel Nava. So there are a lot of options there, and you know, I actually think Gomes is one of the more astute pickups, especially if you're going to play him in a platoon role against left-handed pitching, because he can, you know, he does a pretty good job against the southpaws. But
yeah,
you know, there's way more reason for optimism looking now closely at the Red Sox lineup than perhaps I had heading into this offseason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think...
Oh, yeah, and their bullpen is kick-ass.
Oh, yeah, it's really good. It's really good. Whereas, like, entering last year, it was shaky. It's really good with Hanrahan, if Bailey's healthy. Uihara's a really nice pickup. Andrew Miller in there full season. Tazawa's really good. Bard there full season. Yeah, it's really good. Aceves is kind of more of a long man relief type, or has been that he's not a has been, but he's you know, the unit as a whole is really good. And so where's this team's weakness? Is it the outfield? Is it clearly the outfield?
I don't know if there is like one. I honestly, I want to say health, because looking at their lineup, there aren't really any glaring holes to me. Maybe catcher? I don't know. So, are you content with Saltalamacchia as your everyday catcher?
I would say I probably am. You know, there are spots like that you could see. They're not the best, but I would call Saltalamacchia league average.
Precisely. Yeah. No. Like I'm saying, I'm looking for weaknesses here, but you know, I'm really struggling to come up with one. I think that David Ortiz starting the season on the DL. I mean, David Ortiz is going to start showing signs of aging at some point. He's been able to defy his age for a number of years now. I mean, last year he missed time with injury, but he was, you know, quite productive when he was healthy. But, you know, I mean, I guess at some point he'll start aging, so that could technically constitute a weakness. But really, looking at their lineup, there aren't really a whole ton of performance concerns. I mean, yes, some guys are getting older, and you'll see natural regression. But for me, it's just a matter of staying healthy. And, I mean, outside of perhaps John Lester and John Lackey, the bounce back concerns aren't that pronounced. I mean, Lester, I mean, he really, really struggled last year. There's no question about it. And a lot of people were suggesting that there were mechanical flaws there, and it certainly translated into the performance, putting up his first ERA, you know, north of 3.5 and since like 2007. And the strikeout rates went down, the velocity dipped a little bit, and obviously Lackey, who has yet to justify that ridiculous contract he was handed out. He's had two very forgettable seasons with the Red Sox, and of course last year he was hurt for the entire season. But outside of those guys, there aren't really a whole ton of you know, outstanding concerns for me.
Yeah, and you know, and I think this is a team that, as good as I expect them to be in 2014, this is a team that I think has really positioned itself well for 2014. And you just look at the entire scope of this team. They have a very good mix of young, up and coming talent, high upside guys, even and veteran presence. And you know, David Ortiz is gonna age eventually. One of these years, eventually he'll start to break down, and it might be this year. Who knows? But Yeah, I spent a lot of time around their minor leaguers this week, and it's a really, really good system. I would say it's top 10 in baseball. And then they have guys who, like, if Xander Bogaerts can play shortstop, if he can stick at shortstop, good Lord. Because then you start to look at, like, that's probably their major weakness. Their biggest weakness when you just think about, okay, if everyone's healthy, where is this team weak? They have Steven Drew, who has struggled with health issues. And he's kind of a roll of the dice type for this year. They have Pedro Chiracco, who hit well last year and has he doesn't really seem to be in the long term plan. And then they have Jose Iglesias, who's a wizard defensively, but may never hit 200. But if Bogaerts can stick at shortstop, even if he's not a good big league shortstop, he's below average, then they have a monster there. And then this rotation, as these guys start to leave, as Lackey, I'm not sure, does Lackey have 1 year or two left? But Lackey filters out, there's Alan Webster, there's Ruby De La Rosa, there's knuckleballer Steven Wright. It's so deep. Or even if guys get hurt this year, which could happen
this year.
Yeah, even if guys get hurt this year, you have some depth in your prospects, and maybe 2013 you don't go to the playoffs because some of those guys get injured and some of those prospects aren't great in their debuts. But maybe you go into 2014 with a lot of really good prospects who have been there, who have failed at the big league level and have the opportunity to correct what they did wrong. So I think that overall we both agree that this is a team that's good, and a team that has some real upside and could be a team this year. But I think that this is a team that's really well positioned for the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And on that note, they could be really competitive in 2013, and mm-hmm. they could be competitive in 2014 and have a very different complexion of their lineup. I mean, a lot of guys mm-hmm. are off the books after 2013. Some of the guys that they brought in this offseason were, their stopgap one-year guys, even if they're sort of household names. Napoli, after that sort of physical issue that he had with his hip, he was reduced to a one-year deal. Hanrahan's a one-year deal. Ellsbury only has one more year left on his contract. Steven Drew's only on for a one-year deal. So this is a team that could look very different in 2014, but as you mentioned, there's tons of reasons for optimism given the wealth of high upside guys that they have who may or may not be ready to go in 2014 should injury necessitate that. Xander Bogaerts, like you mentioned, and I think that maybe the consensus is that he probably won't stick at shortstop, but mm-hmm. you probably know better than I would. But I think the physical profile suggests that he's probably destined for third base. But it's a good problem to have, just considering the bat that he has. I think that he has like a career 900 OPS over his minor league tenure. So him and Bradley and Webster and Barnes and all these guys. There is a lot of reason for optimism, and 2014 is going to be an interesting year, even if it's not necessarily a year that's indicative of where they're going as a club, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. What's cool about this system, and I know like a year ago, or maybe not a year ago, but last year, the Yankees said something about this, Brian Cashman said something about this. Was that good players don't want to sign with the Yankees to be backups, so we need to develop good backups, something like that. And I think that the Red Sox system has a lot of good backups coming, and a lot of good depth coming. And I think when you look at the entire scope of the organization, it's good. It's good. And something I talked about this week with people was this is a team that a year ago had terrible contracts all over the field, and was really in bad shape. I don't know where this team, like, would have gone had they not been able to pull off the deal with Crawford and Gonzalez. And so you figure losing, and this was kind of the deal we were talking about, because we had seen that day Alan Webster pitch, and I've gone on about Alan Webster, but he was outstanding. He was incredible. Like, I'm conservatively calling him a number two starter, and I think he's going to do that soon. And then there's, apparently people said Ruby De La Rosa was really good. And the fact that they got rid of those contracts, and they got prospects, and they got not just prospects, but really good prospects.
Mm-hmm.
That's a trade that, you know how, I kind of look back at when the Rangers traded Teixeira as sort of, that set the tone for the next, really the next decade of their team, bringing in Elvis Andrews, bringing in Neftali Feliz. Who else did they brought in? But even just that, I know it was that, and then it was more. It might have been Harrison.
Yeah.
And so that set the team up. But you know, like this is that kind of deal where I think it could be. It could be like that for the Red Sox. It kind of sets them up because of what they got, not only what they got from the deal, but what they got rid of in the deal.
Sure. Addition by subtraction. You know, they identified that Adrian Gonzalez was struggling, and he absolutely was last year. I think he put up the lowest isolated power and walk rate of his career, certainly in recent memory. And, you know, they jettisoned that contract. Which was, it's a significant amount of money. And same goes for Crawford, who, you know, people still aren't sure if he's going to be ready for opening day with the surgery that he had on his elbow. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, for a while there, I wasn't quite sure as to the direction that this team was headed, especially after last year's debacle. But, you know, management made some good moves at the end of the season there. And, you know, they quickly did away with Bobby Valentine. And, you know, even if 2013 isn't necessarily the end goal, so to speak, I think that they're absolutely taking steps in the right direction. And, you know, you could see parts of their future start to factor in 2013, you know, if injuries come up and, you know, they need to call on some of those prospects to come and fill in roles for the big league club. So, lots of reasons for optimism after what was a pretty dark chapter in Red Sox history in 2012.
Yes. And speaking of dark chapters, this has nothing to do with the Red Sox at all. Dark chapters coming to closes. It looks like Vernon Wells' time with the Angels may be coming to a close. Just examining a Jeff Passan tweet. He is apparently close to being a Yankee. Lots of money going back to
the
Yankees.
That's how desperate the Yankees are.
Big factor, how much of $42 million owed Wells do Angels pay? Hearing money going back to Yankees is not nearly as significant as one might think.
Well, the Yankees have no leverage. They are insanely desperate at this point, considering the injuries that they've encountered over the past few weeks.
They gave Brendan Bosch, they gave him, like, what, 1 year, $1 million, something like that?
Yep.
And guaranteed money. That is done.
For a guy who was outright released when he had options remaining.
Yeah. I'm just stuck in these Jeff Passan tweets. Yankees in talks. Important caveat is that Vernon Wells has a no trade clause, and he must greenlight any deal. It wouldn't make sense to me that he wouldn't do it. Yankees official, quote, "I just wonder where this money was in December. So do a lot of others." The quote ended in December, passing through, and so do a lot of others. So, you know, we'll talk about the Yankees later in the week, but it looks like that $189 million thing was not as important as one might think. And this might, if they go out and get Vernon Wells, this might really hurt their leverage with Cano.
Well, yeah, it's going to eliminate some of that financial flexibility, and they're going to need it too, because Cano is going to have every team in baseball pursuing him that has a, you know, an extra dollar to spend. So
I'm pursuing him, not even to play baseball.
No, just to like just file to, your just, income tax report or something.
Just to give me hugs all day.
Yeah. Well, did man, his smile is absolutely infectious. Like
yeah.
Him on the diamond during the WBC, it's like you could not you and Jose Reyes could not possibly be enjoying yourselves more than you're enjoying yourselves right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a very deep personal connection to Robinson Cano growing up. He was the guy I followed. Cuz I remember he came up and it was like, "Oh, who's this 20-something-year-old kid?" I remember watching his first game. I remember nearly getting a foul ball from him and going and seeing him and him being my favorite player growing up. So
how could he not be? He's just so – he's silk. Like his I tweeted this. His primary physical like chemical compound is silk.
That's so true, and I don't know why, but it is.
Because he's too smooth. His level of smoothness should be criminalized.
And he does, and like he makes it look like he's not trying.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So this show's taken a turn, but
to just fawning over Robinson Cano, which
Robinson
I mean, he can really
Cano could turn
us.
Me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
that was said, but yeah, I like Robinson Cano. Vernon Wells, best of luck getting to the Yankees. Yankees, best of luck paying Vernon Wells. But Red Sox, 85 wins, something like that. Good organization. Bobby Valentine's gone. So, Jonah, I think we're ready to get to the end of the show here. Do you have any parting thoughts?
Are you following March Madness?
A little bit. Been traveling and stuff's been going on. But I know that Harvard, who beat Cornell, beat New Mexico, and so transitive property. Cornell should have been a 3 seed in the tournament. I'm yeah. a little bit bitter, but I'm getting over it. Yeah, that's it. I know Florida Gulf Coast. I was listening to the news down. And when I was in Fort Myers, Florida Gulf Coast, their coach, basically nobody down there thought they were going to win their game. And so they kind of just, they just like assumed, okay, well, this will be fun. But so like, let's do some more human interest type pieces and not like focus on the game. And so the coach's wife at Florida Gulf Coast, is apparently like a Vogue model. And so
yeah, they kept showing her on the broadcast.
Yeah, and so I learned about that. I don't know anything about their team. I haven't watched any yet. I'll probably watch later in the week. But it's baseball season, man. I a couple of years ago, I was into this when Stephen Curry was like in it every year for 4 years and like
Davidson, baby Davidson.
Are they doing well?
They lost their first round game to Marquette in one of probably the most exciting finishes of the tournament so far.
Okay, yeah, I'm totally uneducated on college basketball this year.
But that was impressive that I knew that. Like, I sounded like I knew something about it, and I know very little. I just guess for the most part. But anyways, my point is, here's what I'm driving at.
Yep.
So my post-secondary institution that I attend, Carleton University – just won a record-setting 9th Canadian National Championship in basketball just 2 weeks ago. And they won by a margin of like 40 points, something absurd like that. And they always destroy every team they play in. The central thesis here being is that they don't belong in CIS basketball. So here's my proposal. The Canadian National Champion gets a berth in the March Madness tournament. Go.
That would be awesome. That would be so awesome.
Was that feigned enthusiasm or was that authentic?
No, that would be cool. I'm serious. That's authentic. That would be really cool. Like, if they could somehow implement, like, internationally, get other team of other countries involved.
Mm-hmm. And it's just a special dispensation for the Canadian champion. And really, my honest opinion is that under normal circumstances, any Canadian university athletic team would get destroyed by a D1 club. But Carleton is such an anomaly in how dominant they are that they don't belong in the CIS circuit. And frankly, it would open up the NCAA to a whole new market of people who wouldn't otherwise watch March Madness because, hey, you got 40,000 people at Carleton who would probably look because, you know, as far as Canadian University athletics go, Carleton basketball is a pretty big thing. So it's just an idea. So if any NCAA executives are listening to this podcast, and why wouldn't they be?
We're talking to you, Joe.
Yeah.
We know you're listening.
Consider it.
I know Joe listens.
That was the end of my rant, but I actually think that it's not to toot my own horn, but it's not a bad proposal.
No, it's not. It's a good one. I like it.
Thank you.
Cornell wrestler Kyle Dake won his fourth national championship this week in four different weight classes. He's the first person to win four wrestling national championships in four different weight classes. So
that's very impressive.
And so I take credit for that. He went to the same school as me. So, yeah, so we'll talk about other teams tomorrow. Jonah, say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Adios.
Come on, big girl. Let's knock these little pins down.
Oh, my God, are you serious?
Son, people can see you.
Boom! That right there, Tommy Strike.